Welcome to DHC Beechcross Lawcast. I'm Joanne Bell, Legal Director and Knowledge Lawyer in the Employment, Pensions and Immigration team. And this is the second episode in series two of our podcast about the Employment Rights Bill. Today I'm joined by partner Sarah George and consultant Stephen Foster. So good morning, both.
Morning.
Hi.
So by this stage, obviously, we had expected the bill to have gained royal assent and to become the Employment Rights Act, but it's still currently being held up in the parliamentary debating between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, which we refer to as a ping-pong process. But we do, however, expect it now to receive royal assent around the end of November, so with not long to go, really. So today we're going to be talking about the bill's provisions on family-friendly, equality and harassment-related issues. And that's going to include gender equality action plans, protection from for pregnant employees and new mothers, family leave, bereavement leave, flexible working and harassment itself. Now, none of these measures are amongst the provisions still being subject to debate in Parliament. So we are fairly certain that what's in the bill now will remain in the final version. And we discussed some of these topics in our previous podcast series late last year. However, some of the relevant provisions were amended during the parliamentary process, and the government has also now published consultations on two of these topics. And we also know a bit more about the government's intended timeframe for implementation. So today's podcast will update you on all of these key developments. So if we move on to our first topic, which is harassment. Now, expanding workers' protection from harassment is an important part of the bill, isn't it, Sarah? So it initially provided for three main changes to the current law. And could you, first of all, just give us a quick recap of what those are?
Yeah, of course. So the first one I'll mention is the extension of the existing duty on employers to make reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment of their employees. That's extending to a duty to take all reasonable steps to prevent such harassment. That's quite an onerous obligation for employers, but the bill does give the government power to make regulations that will specify steps that will be regarded as reasonable steps for the purposes of complying with the enhanced duty. So that should at least be a useful indication of what we're going to need to do in practice. Secondly, there's a new obligation on employers not to permit the harassment of their employees by third parties. So that covers harassment relating to any of the protected characteristics already covered by the existing harassment provisions in the Equality Act. So age, disability, gender reassignment, race, religion or belief, sex and sexual orientation. Employers will have a defence to a claim of third-party harassment if they can show that they took all reasonable steps to prevent the harassment from occurring. Then finally, sexual harassment is being added to the list of disclosures that count as a protected disclosure for the purpose of whistleblowing protection. Now, to be clear, a disclosure about sexual harassment could already be protected under the existing legislation. So, for example, as a criminal offence, a failure to comply with a legal obligation, or as a health and safety issue. So explicitly providing for the protection of disclosures of sexual harassment is intended to improve employee awareness of whistleblowing protection in these circumstances. And so it could increase the likelihood of claims.
Mm. Thank you, Sarah. And Stephen, are we expecting any consultation on the details of the provisions? And I suppose as well, do we know any more about when the harassment provisions are likely to take effect?
Yeah, in terms of the consultation, as with the earlier consultations that have taken place, quite strangely or deliberately, the consultations are very narrow in their scope. So the consultation that will take place is on, as Sarah's mentioned, the all reasonable steps, which example should be included within the regulations. Now, in terms of timescale on that, there isn't any timescale at the moment on those examples. However, in terms of the provisions themselves, Sarah's mentioned the whistleblowing provision. That's expected probably around April 2026. And then in relation to third-party harassment and the extension to prevent under the all reasonable steps to be taken, we're probably looking at October 2026. Now, what's strange about that is that while we've got those sort of clarity in relation to that, what's a little bit odd is that the roadmap of the government is that in relation to those reasonable steps to prevent harassment, they're only looking to take effect in 2027. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between those two timescales, but that's what we know for now.
Yeah, I mean, and that does actually seem very strange, doesn't it? Given that the steps that are set out in regulations are intended to set a minimum standard for compliance, really. I mean, I suppose it may, remains to be seen whether the government adjusts its planned implementation time frame for this as we go forwards. But in the meantime, is there anything that employers could be doing to prepare?
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of those things that we've been talking about for quite some time now, at least a year, 2 years. So I think employers should be, if they haven't already, undertaking risk assessments to identify high areas of risk. So, for example, I would consider areas where you've got lone workers, or another area might be where you've got a significant imbalance in gender populations within a workforce. Those are the areas I would undertake the risk assessments. And then, flowing from that, obviously, is look at measures you can be taking now and put those in place with the training and consider those measures and fine-tune that before the regulations come in.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, during the parliamentary process, the government added a further provision to the bill that is intended to enhance workers' protection from harassment and discrimination. Sarah, could you talk us through what this new provision does?
Yeah, that's right. So the new provision bans the use of non-disclosure agreements, which most people will recognise as NDAs, non-disclosure agreements that concern discrimination, harassment, and contracts with workers in particular. So the way in which the new provision works is by making any term in an agreement between an employer and a worker void if that provision seeks to prevent the worker from alleging or disclosing information about a number of things, specifically disclosures about harassment or discrimination, about the employer's response to harassment or discrimination, or about the employer's response to the making of the allegation that there has been harassment or discrimination. Now, the prohibition will apply both where the worker is the victim of discrimination or harassment or where they've witnessed such acts, and it's intended to cover all types of harassment and discrimination under the Equality Act. It doesn't expressly mention victimisation. However, I think that's likely to be covered by the reference to those three sort of categories of information. So specifically, disclosures about the employer's response to the making of an allegation. So that seems wide enough to be able to encompass victimisation as well.
Yes, I agree. But this does seem like quite a significant change, particularly given the value that employers often place on ensuring confidentiality, perhaps in settlement agreements where there's been an allegation of discrimination that might impact on the employer's reputation, for example. Is there going to be any exceptions from the ban?
There are, but this is one of those areas where we're waiting for clarity through the regulations, and we haven't really got a timescale on that at the moment, Joanne. It's obviously been in the press and the social media how employers feel about that, as you've quite rightly expressed. What the government has indicated is that there will be accepted agreements, so there will be exceptions to this general rule in relation to certain discrimination and harassment. Now, they haven't really given much detail on that, but the thinking, as we understand from what the government has said at the moment, is that where an employee or worker requests or is happy to agree to such an accepted agreement, then that is it may be one of those areas that they'll identify as an accepted agreement. And the thinking behind that really is that it's a bargaining position for the employee or worker. So if they choose to, they may use that as in their favour to secure agreement on more favourable terms, rather than having the employer impose such a term as a sort of standard precedent.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly that's one view, and I can see why it might be thought that you can potentially accept an agreement whereby the individual has themselves sought to say, I'll agree to give up my confidentiality rights, and that's a benefit to you, employer. But employers are often keen to include confidentiality provisions in settlement agreements in any event because they're concerned about reputational impact if they don't. And, by contrast, NDAs, some are already precluded in some heavily regulated sectors, which may mean the accepted agreements are less relevant to those employers. I think the practical reality is that lots of this will depend on how accepted agreements are going to be defined. It's worth flagging that with the provision potentially significantly reducing employers' ability to insist on confidentiality, we're likely to see an increase in litigation if agreements can't be reached. There's obviously potential for there to be less incentive for employers to settle potential harassment and discrimination claims if they're not going to be able to require workers to keep those details confidential. And again, in some cases, defending the claim might actually be preferable from a reputational point of view in any event.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. It sounds like employers are going to be keen to contribute to this consultation on accepted agreements whenever we get that, whenever it's launched. So speaking of consultations, Stephen, the government have now published two in the realm of family-related proposals, haven't they?
They have. So we're looking at the consultations on bereavement leave, first and foremost, and then we've got the enhanced dismissal protection for pregnant women and new mothers. Both of those were published back in October this year, 2025, and those are open until the 15th of January, 2026.
So starting with bereavement leave, we know from the bill that the current day one right to 2 weeks paid parental bereavement leave on the death of a child under age 18 or the loss of pregnancy after 24 weeks will remain in place, and that alongside this, there'll be a new day one right to at least 1 week of unpaid leave on the death of a close relative or pregnancy loss before 24 weeks. What additional detail does the consultation give us on how the government is proposing to implement the new right?
Yeah, Joe, the consultation considers questions about eligibility for bereavement leave, so when and how long should be taken, and also what, if any, notice or even evidence might be required that an individual is bereaved. It doesn't really tell us anything about the government's preferences or their intentions. It tends to set out possible options rather than any proposed approach to any question. So, for example, on eligibility, the consultation asks us for views on what relationships between the employee and the deceased should qualify the employee for bereavement leave. So as well as immediate and extended family members, suggested options include foster carers, kinship carers, and even close friends. I think if eligibility is that broadly defined, it's going to mean that bereavement leave is more widely used than perhaps employers will be anticipating. The consultation also asks in relation to pregnancy loss, which types of pregnancy loss should be covered, and whether entitlement to bereavement leave should be restricted to the person who has physically experienced the pregnancy loss, and if not, who else should benefit from that entitlement?
Yeah, I think we can sort of assume that the approach of the government, that they will probably be looking to extend that protection and that benefit to partners of those that have suffered the physical loss. So I think we can presume that, but we do need to wait until we see the detail.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought so too. Obviously, the consultation doesn't actually give any suggestions, but that obviously does sound like a fair and sensible approach. Sarah, you mentioned that the consultation also addresses the duration of bereavement leave, but doesn't the bill just provide for 1 week's leave?
Yeah, so the 1 week period set out in the bill is intended to be a minimum, and the consultation's asking whether unpaid bereavement leave should be 1 week, 2 weeks, or some other time period, and also whether the amount of the leave available should be different depending on the employee's relationship to the deceased person. It's also asking whether the employee should have to take the leave in one continuous block or whether bereavement leave could be permitted to be taken discontinuously, so either in blocks of a week or even a day at a time.
Yeah, I think generally, I think most employers are naturally supportive in these circumstances, but I think they need to start thinking about some of the burdens that might arise from these regulations in terms of the extra administration. People can take different durations and different blocks. That's going to take some administrative skills and so forth. And then they'll need to review their policies, implement those policies. And of course, as with all policies, it's no good just having them in the handbook. You're going to have to roll out the training both to HR and to managers, like managers that are dealing with those situations.
Yeah, I agree with that, Stephen. I mean, and those policies are going to need to reflect all the notice requirements for bereavement leave that the government's consulting on. So, for example, it might be that less notice is required for leave that's taken in the immediate aftermath of a death than for leave that might be taken at a later date. So it may not be as simple as stating one simple notice period. I think the policy reviews could be more complicated than we might initially think.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there is a fair amount for employers to consider there. But I think also the proposals on bereavement leave aren't likely to have as much impact as those on enhanced protection from dismissal for the pregnant employees and new mothers. So the bill here only provides minimal details. It basically tells us that employers will be prohibited from dismissing an employee who is pregnant is on maternity leave or has returned from maternity leave within the past 6 months, except in certain specified circumstances. Now, does the consultation shed much more light on what the government wants to achieve with this proposal?
I think the answer to that is there is general government policy, but there's not a precise guidance on it at this stage, Joanne. As we're aware, the government acknowledges that there is already protection for pregnant women and newly mothers in terms of the provisions that are already in place. We know it's discriminatory to treat people less favourably if they have indicated that they intend to take maternity leave or that they've just returned from maternity leave. And there's also the extra provision under Regulation 10 and maternity regulations in terms of ensuring that they have slightly more preferential treatment in terms of any vacancies in a redundancy situation. What I think is strange here is that the government asked a very open question in terms of when should such dismissals be allowed, which is a very, very open question. And some of the examples that we've seen, which we won't go into here, but some of the examples that have been put in place are quite baffling at the moment. So I think we need to see more clarity in regards to that.
Yeah. I mean, in what way do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I mean, the consultation refers to the sort of five potentially fair reasons for dismissal under the Employment Rights Act. So that's conduct, capability, redundancy, illegality, and some other substantial reason, or SOSR, as we discuss it. It suggests that one approach might be to introduce a new tailored test to assess fairness where a pregnant employee or new mother is dismissed for any of those reasons. So, for example, it would potentially require employers to show that the dismissal for the specified reason is necessary to avoid serious harm to the organisation or other staff. I should say, to be clear, that the consultation doesn't define what serious harm is, but just reading between the lines, it might, for example, cover the situation where other staff could be put in danger as a result of the employee breaching health and safety rules. The other suggested approach is to narrow or to remove the potentially fair reasons in dismissals of pregnant employees and new mothers altogether. But there's obvious potential problems with that. They're identified in the consultation itself. And, you know, one example is that if we remove the conduct ground, or it's narrowed so that it only applies as in the case of gross misconduct, where would that leave the employer in a scenario where the employee commits lower level misconduct and is given a final written warning before they become pregnant, and then they repeat that misconduct during their pregnancy?
Yeah, I think that's the dilemma we've got here, Sarah, is that we're seeing protections for individuals, which may be quite problematic, but it puts employers in a very problematic position and how they deal with these situations going forward. So I do think that's something that needs to be sorted, and there could be unintended consequences, I think, arising from this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be extremely challenging for employers to navigate. What do you think those unintended consequences are going to be, Stephen?
I think there's the usual fear. Often you spot this when Regulation 10 comes in under the redundancy exercise and people feel that there's favourable treatment. That creates a bit of discontent between the workforce occasionally. So I think there could be a natural human reaction to this within workforces. But I also think that there's difficulty in terms of recruitment. Employers may become more reluctant to engage and recruit women of a childbearing age, which it could have obviously the opposite effect of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
So whilst it sounds very negative, actually, that's the reality of the situation. And we need to be alert that by trying to bring these provisions in, we're not actually making things harder for women indirectly.
I mean, there's also the issue of practicability as well. So if we think about the point in time at which the enhanced protection from dismissal would kick in, the consultation is asking whether it should be when the employee tells the employer that they're pregnant, or should it be at an earlier stage, such as when the employee discovers they're pregnant, or, oddly, when they become pregnant, even if they don't know themselves of their own pregnancy. So any option that provides protection when the employee is unaware of the employee's pregnancy just seems totally unworkable. And honestly, it's quite surprising that the government's even putting them forward for consideration.
Yeah, completely agree. Seems very strange. And this is obviously going to create problems for employers. But I suppose if this is the sort of feedback that employers provide in response to the consultation, then hopefully the government will take it into account when deciding how to proceed and the approach that they're actually going to take in the regulations. Now, just before we move on from this topic, is there anything else in the consultation that employers should be aware of, Stephen?
Yeah, I think an important point here is that the government has reserved its powers to extend these protections to parents on other types of similar leave, so it might be the parental leave or et cetera. So they're looking to do that and exercise that power. So I think we need to be alert to that. And the government is actually seeking views on whether or not it should exercise that power. So that's something to be alert to. They are still considering that, and that could have a wider impact in terms of the working population and employees.
Yes, thanks, Stephen. So given how much the government is going to have to work through when considering consultation responses, and indeed how complicated the new provisions may well be, it is obviously a bit of a relief to employers that they aren't due to come into force until 2027. And one other change that's only expected to take effect in 2027 concerns flexible working. Now, the government hasn't yet published a consultation on this, Sarah, but can you remind us what's planned?
Yeah, so the change to flexible work seems quite subtle on the face of it, actually. The starting point is to be a statutory right to request flexible working. So it's not a right to have it. The current 8 permitted business reasons for refusing a request are going to remain in place. However, under the new rules, employers are only going to be able to refuse a request if they can show that the refusal for one or more of those reasons is reasonable. Now, that is a shift in dynamic that's expected to make it harder for employers to reject a request and easier for employees to challenge rejections. But the impact of it in practice is going to depend on the level of scrutiny the employment tribunals apply when they're faced with considering those challenges. Once the new law's in force, it's going to be some time before we get claims through into the tribunals, and even longer before we get to any kind of appellate authority. So we're probably going to have to wait a while to see whether there's any sort of real degree of certainty or messages that can be taken from the new law. In terms of the consultation, we're anticipating that it's going to focus on the process that employers have to follow when handling flexible working requests. There hasn't been any suggestion from the government that's going to cover the legal tests that tribunals are going to have to consider.
Okay, thank you. So we'll have to wait to see really whether there's any surprises in that consultation. But turning now to a couple of changes that the government intends to bring in force rather sooner. So we're thinking now of April 2026. Stephen, can you remind listeners what's planned for family leave rights?
Yeah, I think the main ones to focus on here are the statutory rights in terms of paternity leave and unpaid parental leave. Both currently are subject to requirements for continuous service of 6 months and 1 year, respectively. Those will both become day one rights. So that's quite a significant change for employers. One thing to point out in relation to the statutory paternity pay, that will still be subject, as we understand it, to a 6 month continuous service qualification. So whilst the right applies, the actual pay provisions are not necessarily changing. In terms of one area that is helpful to employers, I think, is that currently there's been some confusion and a requirement to take your paternity leave before any shared parental leave. That's going to be removed, as we understand it, under the regulations. So again, some mixed messages there, slightly confusing in some ways, but clarity also being provided in other areas, which I think is very, very useful. Another positive here is that we're not really waiting for any more clarification or, in terms of regulations and what's required. So this is one of those areas that I think employers can again start preparing for, put the policy, amend their policy, start the training, get their managers and HR up to speed, because all that's required now is really the commencement provisions from the government.
Yeah, I mean, although I think it's worth flagging that in the much longer term, we might see further changes to family leave rights as the government has launched a review and call for evidence on the entire family leave framework. So that review opened in July. It's expected to run for 18 months. And after that, the government's intending to produce a roadmap of next steps for potential reform of the law around family-friendly rights. According to the terms of reference, the fact that the review's got such a broad scope doesn't mean that all family leave rights are going to be changed, but the government's thinking is that a comprehensive review of the system's needed, just to be sure that any changes do deliver improvements for work and families. It's also emphasised the scope to consider additional needs that might not be covered by existing entitlements, so looking at things like the needs of kinship carers and self-employed parents. So that's something to watch.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sarah. So yeah, some things still in to think about for the future as well. But there's one more measure which was dealt with in the bill that we wanted to touch on today, and that's the introduction of the requirement for large employers to produce gender equality action plans. Stephen, what details do we have about this at this stage?
I think at this stage, employers will be familiar with the gender pay gap reporting. So that applies to employers with 250 or more employees. This is the government wishing to take this further with these gender equality action plans. So when the employer submits the gender pay gap report, there'll be a form to complete in terms of the gender pay gap action plan. And there'll be ideally a list of actions that are available for employers to tick and how they to indicate how they're going to address the pay gap that if they've identified one, and also interesting in how they're going to support those suffering in terms of menopause. The requirement to produce these action plans is officially going to take effect in 2027, although they are encouraging employers to try and do this on a voluntary basis from April 2026. And also encouraging employers to publish the action plans that they agree to on their website, or the actions that they've taken on their website. So there's lots that we do know. I think there's more to come. But in terms of the government itself, they've indicated that they're also going to consult with the Equality and Human Rights Commission on the content of these action plans. So there's a bit more detail to come, which I think will be useful for employers. But if we're looking at April 2026 for the voluntary provisions, I think the government's got a lot of work to do between now and then.
Okay, thank you very much. So thank you, Sarah and Stephen, for all of your insights. And if any of our listeners would like to contribute to the forthcoming consultations, you can do that in various ways. So you can do it directly online, or you can speak to your usual DAC Beechcroft contact. We'll also be launching some surveys in the next week or two to inform our own response. So that's also another way to get involved, and we'd like your engagement and feedback if you can. We'll be releasing another podcast next month where we'll provide a wrap-up on where the bill has got to in its progress towards implementation. And we also plan to host another live webinar early next year on the trade union and industrial relations provisions. For now, though, thank you, Sarah and Stephen, and thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Sharon. Thanks very much.